Welcome to Show Me Your Mic. I'm your host, Chris Enns. Show Me Your Mic is a podcast where I talk to other podcasters about their podcasts, and we kind of explode in a circle of podcasting. For episode 37, I'm joined by Ashley Milentite. She is the host of Broad Experience over at thebroadexperience.com, hosted also on the VO Radio Syndicate. And we talk in this episode about podcasting, women in podcasting. We talk about some of the techniques she uses for crafting a better story in her podcast, aiming for a shorter podcast. This one is an hour, nowhere near short, and just trying to talk about the craft of podcasting and see if we can elevate our game. So enjoy the show. Welcome to the show, Ashley.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, your friend or colleague or associate or just person on Twitter, Anna, had tweeted to you, and I follow her and somehow saw this exchange and was like, oh, I should connect with this person who's on a lesser known podcast, because I'm on a lesser known podcast.
There are many of us out there.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, welcome to the show. You're based in New York, if I'm not mistaken. And you're about 30 some, I think you're about the same, actually, 30 some episodes into the Broad Experience as well, right?
Yes. I just released episode 34 earlier this week.
So I've got you by three.
You have, yes.
But yes, I'm a little more infrequent than you do on a biweekly schedule, if it sort of looks like.
Yeah, however you say every fortnight. Right. No one ever uses that word anymore, but twice a month. So bi-monthly, I think, might be the correct way to describe it. Yes. I have taken breaks because I just can't keep up with that schedule relentlessly. It's just too much. So I took a sort of 6-week break sort of from the middle of December until fairly recently, and then got back to that 2-week schedule. And then in the summer, I didn't produce any shows in August last summer because I was teaching, and Mule's pretty good about allowing for your life. And since my show involves it's not just me and somebody else. It involves me booking interviewees, guests. Often I'm interviewing them personally, and then I have to come back, go through all the tape and turn it into a sort of storytelling podcast. And that takes a long time. So it does get pretty relentless after a while. So you do need a break sometimes. I suppose if you had a team of people working with you, then it would be great. But I'm doing this all on my own on top of other work. So I have to step away from it sometimes, or I just couldn't keep it up.
Yeah. And I want to get into some of the producing aspects of your show in a minute. Cause it is a different style than what, I don't know. I struggle with whether it's traditional, cause who knows what traditional podcasting is at this point. I don't know if you've been around long enough to say what's traditional. I like to call it sort of the lazy person's podcasting, cause it's kind of less editing, less produced, and just kind of whatever ends up on the air ends up on the air. But that's what's, I guess, beautiful about this medium right now, is we're kind of all sorting it out as we go. But going a bit to your background, which I'll have links to your full bio and stuff, obviously, in the show notes, which you can find at sskTN.com/show me your mic. And this will be episode 37, like I said. But you had mentioned in your bio, your dad was in radio with the BBC, and sort of your initial reaction was that radio wasn't cool, but TV was, and you kind of came back to it later. What was your sort of introduction to working in radio initially, in audio, I guess?
So what happened was I moved to the States from London when I was 25, and I'd never really listened. I'd never, put it this way, I'd never willingly listened to radio in the UK, other than, of course, you know, music radio, which was what everyone listened to. But my parents would always have, you know, BBC Radio 4 playing in the background when we were growing up, you know, news and these very serious voices. And I just thought it was so boring. And it was just, it was the background sound to our lives for years. And also sometimes my dad, when he retired when I was quite young, but when he was working still at the World Service, he would have to listen to this particular current affairs program right in the middle of Sunday lunch. So the radio would sit there on the table, and my brother and I were not allowed to talk because he had to hear this vitally important radio program before he produced a show at some point later in the week. And so I basically resented radio, thought it was boring, and had no intention of ever going into it. But then when I moved here to the US, I realized that everything they said about America was true in that you really don't get good news about the rest of the world. Okay, now I know there are a million cable channels, but at the time I wasn't exposed. I didn't have a TV. I was with a roommate. She had a TV. But what I found to watch on that, I thought was crap, basically. I didn't consider it real news compared to what I had grown up with. And so I just kind of discovered US public radio by accident when I would come home late, as I used to do in those days. I would just fiddle with a dial while I was getting ready for bed, and I came across, you know, New York Public Radio and NPR. And I kind of, first of all, I was glad to find somewhere that reported on the rest of the world. But then as I began to listen to it, you know, all the time when I was at home over the next few years, I realized that it told wonderful stories. And I fell in love with that storytelling style. And it just became the way I got my news. I mean, I still hardly ever watch television news. I went through a period of watching the BBC News when I had access to it on BBC America, but I don't anymore. So I get basically most of my information through my ears. And I just kind of fell in love with the storytelling. You know, I mean, shows like This American Life that are listened to all around the world seduced me. And then, but even the news stories, I mean, it's amazing what you can do even in only a couple of minutes. I'm working on a story right now for one of the big public radio shows here, and it has to be 2 minutes, which kind of kills you on one hand, but it's also very challenging and very good for your writing to know how to have to put together a story, including three interviewees and various cuts in 2 minutes flat. So I thought, I would like to do that. That's really cool. I wonder if I could do that for a living. And eventually, actually just before 9/11, on the eve of 9/11, I got on a plane to go back to London to do a 3-month journalism course in London. And when I came back from that in early 2002, I started badgering my local public radio station to see if they would take me as an intern. And that is kind of what led to me then working in public radio on and off ever since, was this internship that then led to another internship at a business show called Marketplace, which then led to me being a reporter there. So I basically learned everything I knew about doing radio stories at Marketplace. And of course, I began to listen to lots of podcasts over the years. But so I basically I wanted to tell stories on the radio, and I eventually got to do that. And it all started with me seeking out news about the rest of the world and then falling in love with the storytelling.
Interesting. So now I'm going to have to go back. That was about four, just when you said 2 minutes, there's about four or five minute dialogue there. They'll have to go back and edit down to chop into a 2-minute story, right?
That's right. You're you can practice your editing skills by doing that.
Which, it's funny when you say, you know, coming to America and being sort of entranced with shows like This American Life, which I appreciate now too. But I know for me, listening to shows that I hear from the BBC and across the pond, which is, you know, it's the different accent and everything, I think that just lends it to being foreign and more exciting and stuff. And so I hear that, and obviously your accent now too, but that seems exciting to me in the stuff here. Like, I'm up in Canada, and so we have lots of good public radio as well that is similar to down what you have in the States. And the British stuff is always kind of interesting and exciting as well. But yeah, it's just what you know is familiar and less intriguing, I guess. And so
yeah,
that's where it comes from. But as an intern, you sort of started into the radio, and where did you make the transition to doing something on your own, a podcast that would be your own thing, as opposed to, you know, which obviously you're still doing, filing news reports and audio pieces for radio, but what was the impact?
So what happened was, I sort of went freelance in 2010, and in 2011, I found out about this course at CUNY, the City University of New York, in entrepreneurial journalism. And I didn't really know what that meant, to be honest. It's run by Jeff Jarvis. I don't know if you follow him or, right. or know yeah. him. You know, he's a big media guru. And I had interviewed him a bunch of times for my stories for Marketplace, the business show that I worked for. But I'd never actually met him. But he ran this course at CUNY. So I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. And I looked into it and I thought, well, I just felt that as a freelancer, any bit of help that I could get was probably worth investing in. And it wasn't too expensive and it was right here and it was just for one term, one semester. And so I thought, okay, I'll apply. And I was interviewed and I got in. But when I got there, I realized that they were very serious about everybody launching a media business while we were there. I mean, I'd sort of known this, but for some reason, I don't know why, my brain just didn't really take it seriously. I thought, well, I won't really have to actually launch a project, will I? But they were very serious about it. So of course I knew I was going to do something audio related because that's my passion. And, you know, it was going to be a podcast. And I'd done a lot of stories when I was at Marketplace, or you know, not a lot, but my favorite feature stories had ended up being about some aspect of women's lives. And I don't know why I started reporting those stories. It wasn't because I had a particular interest in it, because at the time I didn't. But I started doing these stories and I felt I learned something really interesting and intriguing every time I did these stories, and started thinking about the different things that men and women face at work and just the way they handle money, all these things I began to find really interesting. And so I decided when I was at CUNY, they said you have to be really specific and niche in what you're going to launch. So I thought, well, why don't I focus this? I knew I wanted the show to be about some aspect of women's lives, not lifestyle, because I just don't care. So I knew it was going to have to be something sort of serious, but something I found juicy and worthy of reporting and interesting to others. And I figured women in the workplace, I did all my research. I knew that the vast majority of women worked. I knew that, you know, women are increasingly educated. Educated people download podcasts, all those things. So I focused the show on women in the workplace. And this was long before I knew that, you know, Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg was going to write this tome called Lean In that would sort of bring the masses to the cause. But I'm glad she has. Of course, I would love to ride on her coattails in some way. But yeah, so that's how it started. It kind of started at CUNY. And then I enjoyed doing it so much that I just carried on with it afterwards.
And so I'm curious about what you would learn, and maybe I understand it's not just that you were learning specifically about podcasting and stuff. It was more journalism and digital journalism and things like that. But as it relates to, because often podcasters like myself are kind of, this is a hobby and this is just a thing we do. And I don't have any journalism training, which, you know, longtime listeners probably are very well aware of. But there's lots of stuff online, you know, like podcastingschool.com and whatever, all the different sites that gurus, supposed gurus and stuff, and buy my courses and all that kind of stuff. But in the more traditional school training education world, what kind of stuff did you take away from that as it relates to podcasting that maybe others like myself could benefit from?
Well, I hate to tell you, I learned nothing about podcasting on that course. That course was specifically about really sort of mostly digital journalism, and then how do you make a business out of this project that you want to do? It was about how do you become a media entrepreneur? I'm completely self-taught when it comes to podcasting. I was used to working in a newsroom where a team of union engineers mixed my stories. I mean, I never mixed my own pieces. I would record my tracks. I would send my actualities down the ISDN line to LA where the show was made, and that would be it. It would be done. It would be magically mixed and air half an hour later, but it wasn't done by me. So I had never put anything together myself until I produced that first podcast.
Nice.
So I'm afraid I can't tell you anything useful because I'm completely self-taught.
Well, then I guess more from the storytelling aspect of it, I guess, which maybe I'll get into that in a minute, because we'll cover just some of the gear stuff that people often ask about with podcasting. And I think sometimes they tune into this show just to hear about mixers and mics and whatever, and then I only end up spending 2 minutes or less on that part. So I just want to make sure I cover it off anyway, because I know that's often what people are wondering about. So what you're at a home office right now, it sounds like, or what you described, and you have set up there. And then you also do a bit of recording. I know some of your shows, you have sort of group settings and things like that, where you've interviewed a bunch of people at the same time. What kind of gear do you use to facilitate all that variety of different spaces?
Sure. Well, I think my answer is going to be very different from the vast majority of people you talk to, because I'm not a gear geek at all. I'm come kicking and screaming into a world that requires technology and gear just because I happen to love audio storytelling, and oh God, it involved gear. So I had to get used to that. You know, I am so not technical naturally. So it's been a good baptism of fire for me. So, I mean, basically I've always owned my own digital recorders because, you know, for about 10 years, you know, when I stopped interning, I said to the engineer at WNYC, the local public radio station, "So what microphone should I buy?" And he said, "Well, you know, the Shure SM58 is really hardy and it's only about $100. Why don't you start with that?" I've been using that microphone ever since for all my interviews. It's a bit battered now. But so that's the mic I use. And then I now have, you know, I started using mini disc recorders back in the day. And now I have a Marantz PMD660, you know, digital recorder, which is like a brick. It's annoyingly brick-like. I wish it was smaller because the mini discs were so beautifully small. And like, as a girl, I can put it in my handbag. You know, I can put it in my purse and take it somewhere. Right, yeah. When you live in New York City, I think unlike a lot of my fellow audio reporters who live in other parts of the country, they can drive to their assignments. They can drive to interview people. I am never driving anywhere. So everything has to go in my purse or in another bag on my back. So I like light equipment, and I feel very sad at the death of the mini disc recorder for that reason. But as well as my brick-like Marantz, I'm looking at a little Olympus LS10 handheld recorder, which sort of looks like Mickey Mouse because it has these two little built-in mics, and they have these it has the little windsock thingies on top. And I love this recorder. They don't make it anymore. They've made another one, a more recent iteration, that apparently isn't as good. I don't know if you know, there's a great site, and it's really designed for people, for radio people, but it's called The Transom, transom.org, which has fantastic gear reviews, actually. Some people listening might want to know about that. Oh, yeah. It's a great site for anyone wanting to you know, consider this stuff. I mean, it's primarily designed for reporters and people who are going out into the field, but I still think it's very useful, even if you are doing stuff from home.
That's
transom.org. So basically, you know, I have these two recorders, and when I'm going to be running around all day in, say, Manhattan on the subway, I don't want to carry that brick around with me because it's so heavy, then I'll take the Olympus, and I haven't been using an external mic with it. I think the internal mics are great. And when you're just doing a one-on-one interview, you don't need the external mic. It's not like I'm going to the zoo and I need to get the sound of, you know, the elephant breathing or something. So this thing is fine. But with the Marantz, I always use it with the Shure mic. I just got an RE50 mic, which is really, really common in audio news world. I thought after 10 or 11 years, I should really expand my repertoire. And I don't have a shotgun mic or any other fancy mics because I haven't really needed one, but I think I'm going to expand again. So really what I'm doing is I'm physically meeting people and interviewing them with my gear. When I interview people remotely, I try and avoid Skype. I mean, this sounds really good, but when I'm using a mic, I take it you're using a mic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had an interviewee recently and she was in the UK, and Skype just seemed like the best way to do it. I mean, the sound quality is okay. It didn't come in and out or any of the things that sometimes happen with Skype, but she just had the mic on her, you know, machine. So it just, it sounded like Skype.
Yeah.
And I, again, because I've been sort of raised in this public radio world, they're very strict about sound. And you're sort of not allowed to use phone tape for a lot of your stories. It has to be a deadline story for them to let you just tape someone who's on a phone. And of course, the quality is even worse when it's a cell phone. And so many people now don't even have landlines. So it's kind of destroying audio quality across the board. But, I have been recently, it's been brilliant. I just did an interview like this yesterday. If the person has an iPhone, I just get them to tape themselves on the voice memo app on their iPhone. So I call them on a landline or on another phone, a cell, whatever. So they're holding what? They're holding a landline up to one ear. They're holding their iPhone up to the other ear. And they're just hitting record on the voice memo app. And unfortunately, you can't talk and talk and talk on the voice memo app on the iPhone. You have to hit stop before about 7 minutes because the phone refuses to email files that are longer than that. So I use a stopwatch, and after about 6 minutes, I'll say, hey, let's stop that file. Could you just hit done? We'll start another file. And the quality, for most listeners, they couldn't tell that it wasn't studio sound.
Nice.
It's really good.
That's a good little hack, yeah.
Yep. So that's what I've been doing recently because, to be honest, the public radio shows are doing that now. Increasingly, they don't want to spend money to send a guest in a remote part of the country to a local studio because they have to pay for the rental of that studio. So now the first question they want to know is, does the guest have an iPhone? And if they do, they get the guest to tape themselves either using the voice memo app or depending on the show, they may have a fancier method. They may get them to download a specific app, which they can then directly upload to that show's own server. It kind of depends who you're doing the work for. But obviously, little old me, just wanting really good sound, I'll ask the person if they have an iPhone. If they don't, I've been looking actually. I had a shout out to a radio group I'm with saying, what apps do you use to get good sound when somebody's in another part of the country? So there are other apps. The Android built, I don't have an Android phone, but I got a potential guest to send me some test audio of her taping herself on the app that the Android phone comes with. You know, I mean, ostensibly it's just meant to kind of help you in conferences and meetings capture some sound. Wasn't as good. It just was not. It was notably inferior to the sound of the voice memo app that comes with the iPhone. So,
well, and you're also sort of at the whim of whatever Android device they may have, whereas iPhone, at least there's four models or whatever that they might have. And generally the mic will be decent to good, whether Android could be just about anything, I guess.
Yeah. So that's been, as you say, that's the little hack that I've been using lately. But I don't have a mixing board. I mean, I don't have any of this stuff that I bet most of your listeners have.
Well, or many of the listeners are lusting after anyways. One of the two, they're in two camps. Either they're like me and they've spent way too much money on a fancy mixer that there's no way they're going to get enough money back to pay for other than it's a fun hobby, or they're lusting after some sort of fancy mixer that they will in turn then not really make enough money to justify having, but it's a fun hobby and that's why we do this. There's a few different places. So you're editing then on your computer, Mac?
Yeah,
or PC?
I use Adobe Audition software. Yeah.
And when you're one thing I was going to mention just for folks who are listening, there's a couple of apps that might be of interest. I just started my own little daily podcast show thing, just audio journal almost kind of thing, and was exploring some of this, using an iPhone to record myself more or less, and without trying to be quick and easy without all the extra gear and whatever that I normally require, I guess, or whatever the word is for myself. But one of them is Dropvox. So instead of Dropbox, it's Dropvox. And it's sort of combines those two services where it's an app that allows you to, you record audio into it, but then it saves it to your Dropbox. So in your case with a guest, explaining Dropbox may or may not be a good, an easy process. Sometimes they already have it. They know, very aware of what it is, wouldn't be a problem. And then you could record quite large apparently with it. I haven't used it that much myself yet, but that's one. And then it's not free. It's $1.99, a couple bucks. But, and the other one is this new service/app called Ophonic, I think is how you say it. AUPHONIC.com. Similar thing where they have a iOS and Android app that you record into. But what's nice about this is it then sends it off, if you want to, you don't have to use this, but it sends it to their service, their site for audio post-production, and then it can then pump that file out to numerous different places, again, Dropbox, to a FTP site, to a web server, to what else, YouTube, all that kind of stuff. So it kind of can enable it to take care of that kind of stuff for you as well. Or you can just have it send you the file again. So for folks who are looking for other things that are out there, that's another neat little service I've come across that could work.
Yeah.
And then you're hosting through with Mule. I don't know the exact arrangement how this works, but you know, they presume they have their site. You have your site for as well, thebroadexperience.com. And just, is there a decision in having your own site as well as the Mule site, and sort of, again, whether it's traditional or whatever, the experience I've noticed is often if it's hosted one place, people just tend to leave it there, but you sort of have both worlds going. And is that somewhat intentional, or is it just kind of the way it ended up?
No, very intentional. Well, so I joined Mule about a year ago. So I think it was actually February of 2013, but I made my first podcast. I want to say it was the very end of March 2012. That one, I was still a student at CUNY, and this, you know, it was my professor who said, well, you have to make a, you know, what's it called? Not a prototype. I can't remember the word. But anyway, you have to make an example episode because...
A pilot or something.
Exactly. Right, yeah. And because we had to present in front of potential investors at the end of the semester. And he's like, you've got to have something to show people, even if you only play a tiny excerpt, they need to have something that they can go and assess your content. So I kind of... I did it rather unwillingly, I have to say, because I just had so much work to do already. And it was just that thing of being scared, you know. I mean, I do this show in part because I exemplify a lot of these problems, which I think women suffer from, which is, you know, some of them are confidence related. And it's why there are so few women podcasters compared to men. Women don't think that we can do this. We don't give ourselves permission to just go out there and do something like this. So that being on that CUNY entrepreneurial course was very helpful for me from that perspective. But so of course, initially it was just me on my own. So of course I had to have a website where the show lived. And so when I joined Mule, there was never a question of my website going away. But also, you know, this is my brand. I mean, I want it to be, and I'm growing it, and I want this eventually to really pay me properly. I mean, for me, it is something that I'm doing on the side, but I think there's definitely a market for the content. So I need to, part of another reason that I keep the website sort of alive with is written content. I don't just post a show there every fortnight because I know that wouldn't be enough to keep people coming to the site. So I also blog. I mean, not as regularly as I should because I just don't have time. But I want to keep sending people to the site and having people go to the site. And I know that you can't just have audio sitting there for 2 weeks to get people to do that. Most people are not going to listen to it from the site. They're going to listen to it by downloading it from iTunes or Stitcher or wherever. So I keep the site to send people to because it's my brand. It's my baby. I birthed it. The whole thing was my idea, and I want people to be going to the brand name site, The Broad Experience, rather than to Mule, to sort of get an idea of the content. Because of course, you know, if you're introducing the show to somebody who's never heard of it, it's great to just be able to send them to the website where they can read all about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's kind of like in TV, and I would imagine within, I don't know all the behind the scenes stuff in radio, but the idea of syndication where, you know, it's played in one place, but it can also be played in other places, and the file itself looks like it's stored on SoundCloud or whatever, and so it's still getting played no matter where it's actually pasted onto some web page or whatever. I could paste it on my page on my own blog or whatever if somebody wanted to play it there too, and you still get the plays and tracking all that kind of stuff for numbers. And so, yeah, it's something I'm curious about, but I think it's something that more podcasters should be, encouraged or investigating, I guess, just to get their content out there and not be sort of beholden to hang on to it so tightly, but while still maintaining their brand, like you said, and their home base almost on the web, so that people, because I mean, Mule is great, but they could decide that they want to shut it down because it's not doing something they want it. And then you'd be left sort of hanging. So at least this way you've got your home base. So
exactly.
Not that those folks over there are doing great work and stuff, but.
Yeah, I don't think they're planning to do anything like soon.
No, and it's such an interesting time with podcasting. It's just seems to be, each time I think we've sort of plateaued, you know, and okay, now we'll see the drop off in terms of this sort of hobby thing that's kind of growing and getting bigger and bigger and more people doing it, and then someone else jumps on board and kind of rides another wave, and keeps just growing. So it's great. And you brought up an interesting point that something that I've sort of struggled with, I guess, or I don't know if struggled is the right word, but in finding women to interview for this show, because there isn't a lot. And I was going to, before I was going to look just through iTunes and see what, you know, as far as featured and stuff that Apple does in their podcast directory of women versus men versus whatever, you know, in terms of listing and stuff like that. And it's tough to know whether it's just what I happen to be seeing in my circles and gravitate towards. Is that the case? Or if it's just in general, and like what you said, it seems to be more of a general issue of women either not wanting to or feeling like they shouldn't or can't get into podcasting. And what do you see as sort of the, I guess, in your conversations with on your show, but also just in your attempts to get the show going, what do you see as things that are sort of helpful and ways of encouraging women to get into this fun, what I consider anyways, a fun medium and a fun thing to do?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a great article on this that on that site I mentioned, Transom, that probably went up about a year ago or last spring, somewhere, you know, somewhere within the last kind of 9 to 12 months, and asking this very question: why are there so few women podcasters? And because I had actually blogged about this at my other site, my regular, the site that's just my name, where all my work is posted when I've had something published. Because I was giving a talk at a local college here about women in radio and podcasting. And I decided I'm going to go on iTunes and just see how many shows are hosted by a woman versus a man. And I did go through all the 200 top ones. And it was, honestly, depending on the day, because of course it changes, but yeah. Depending on the day, one day it was as few as 5. Another, I counted 15. But even 15, that's still tiny out of 200. But when it comes to iTunes, as everyone knows, the shows that tend to make it onto iTunes, they're shows, they're CBC shows, they're NPR shows. They tend to be shows that are actually radio shows that are also popular podcasts, which isn't the same as an indie, you know, like myself, producing a show out of her closet and her living room.
Yeah.
So those people, I mean, God, you'd be incredibly lucky to make it into the top 200 at all if you're, you know, if you're an independent, because nobody knows you exist. I think, but there is overlap between women as hosts of radio programs and women as podcasters. I don't know what it's like at the CBC because I have not checked CBC statistics, but I know all the shows here, and I did a count, and there were always fewer women hosts of shows too. Co-hosts, sure, you get a guy and a woman co-hosting together, but there are far fewer lone female hosts of shows than there are lone male hosts of shows. And when it, you know, when it comes to women doing the, you know, wanting to go off and start a podcast, I can tell you, I would never have done this if I hadn't gone and done that entrepreneurial journalism course and had a professor saying, you have to make a pilot. Come on, you've got to put this together. You've got to have something to show for yourself. I would have used all the usual excuses like, oh, well, but I'm not a host. I'm a reporter. I just go out and report and then I come back and put it together. And I don't know how to podcast. I've never done that before. All these things that I think come far more to women's minds because women just in general still have a much lower level of confidence than guys. A guy will just think, I'll go out and do that. Of course, why not? Whereas a woman will think of 10 reasons why she shouldn't do that thing and why she's not good enough to do that thing. And I think that's a major reason. So the only way to get more people to do it is, of course, to, you know, to kind of talk about it and be encouraging and say, why not try it? Just try one and see how it goes and see how you like it. Because for me, making that first show and realizing, oh, yes, I can do this. All the experience I have as an audio reporter is standing me in good stead was incredibly helpful. And I'm actually helping somebody at the moment, a woman I met who read about the podcast in The Guardian. She's a journalist, but she has no audio experience, but she really wants to start a podcast. So I'm sort of consulting with her for a little bit to get her comfortable with audio as a medium so that she can go off and start her own show. So I think, honestly, it's making people, it's telling women, why not? Just have the same attitude as a guy. Why not try it? See how it goes. See how much you enjoy it. And if you enjoy it, keep doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where, you know, in I'm in a bit of the sort of the tech nerd circles that in terms of the podcast I listen to, I tend to gravitate towards those, besides some of the usual, like This American Life and a few, you know, shows like that. But, and it is fairly male dominated, but whenever there's a woman on the show, it's not like a reaction of like, what is this woman doing? You know, talking about Talia. It's a fresh take. Like, I'm tired of, frankly, of guys talking about gear and stuff, and it's nice to have a different view on some of that stuff. And even looking at, just when you mentioned CBC, I was just looking through the radio site, and there is a few key shows that we have. Like, I'm just thinking throughout the day that I listen to, and The Current with Anna Maria Tronte, and a few of the shows that we have that are would be woman led. What's the word? Not an answer,
but Spark. I've just come across Spark, yeah. The tech show, which I'm really enjoying.
Yeah, and that's, to me, that's the sort of the, what's the word? A good show to point to, because it's kind of in that, both in the audio podcasty kind of space, but also in news, but also tech too, which is two areas that, like you said, are kind of underrepresented. But she's and I'm drawing a blank on her name right now.
Nora Young.
Yes, Nora Young does such a great job with that show, and and is well worth listening to for any number of reasons, not just because it's a woman leading the show, obviously.
Yeah, I know. That shouldn't matter, but no. It is. I mean, I never noticed that most of the shows I was listening to were hosted by guys. I honestly never noticed. And even when I got interested in this topic, I still didn't notice until someone else brought it to my attention and said, I'd like you to talk about this when you come and give your talk. And I thought, oh, really? Are there more shows hosted by men? And then I started to notice it. And the thing is, I mean, this is, you know, anyone who works in this kind of arena of gender, I hate the word gender, but I will say it. You know that as a society, for millennia, everything has come from men. So we're used to hearing men being, you know, the voice of authority. And women are just as used to it as guys are. So you don't even notice when most of your audio or, you know, stuff you see on TV is coming from guys, because you're used to guys being the one that tell you things. So when I'm much more cognizant of it now, and I really enjoy it when I hear a woman hosting a show, because I'm noticing just the different take that comes from that. I notice the same thing when I watch, you know, these comedies, some of these American comedies now that are written by and starring women like Mindy Kaling, you know, who used to be in The Office. I really notice the different themes that come up, and you didn't notice them before because just every show you were watching was created and written by guys or by a team that involved men and women. And I'm just noticing more now when I watch these comedies that are written by women that I'm getting just different types of stories and that I didn't even realize I was missing, you know, because you don't know what you're missing until you actually see an alternate version. But it's interesting.
Which is just the humor thing that you brought up, which is just to point to people on the most recent episode. I was listening to a few random episodes of your show, The Broad Experience, and oh yeah, it was episode 34, Making Them Laugh, and sort of women and men and humor in the office, and the discussion that you had with Judith Baxter, right? Yeah, just pulling it up here. We don't have to go into a long discussion, just to point listeners to that as an example of something that you were talking about on your show that's kind of somewhat related to this. How do you go about in producing your show? I want to get into some of the just the aspects, like you alluded to, of, you know, a 15-minute sort of time limit roughly that you've imposed on yourself, sometimes 10 minutes, you know. What's the process like? So you have a conversation, you know, you and I are having this conversation, let's say, and pretend the roles are reversed and you're the host. Now you're going to take this back and edit this, and we're at, you know, 40 minutes now, and sort of putting you on the spot, I guess, because it wasn't that you were prepared to, you haven't been thinking maybe in the same way that you normally would. But what would you do with this then that to help sort of shape it into a 15-minute or 10-minute or whatever kind of story?
So with something like this, it's a conversation. This would be in public radio. We call this a two-way. Say we were to stop at 40 minutes, and I have edited down these conversations. It's a question of going through. And first of all, what I always do with all my interviews and what I would do with this is I log the whole thing, which is so tedious. But it also, so I'm listening and I'm typing and I'm basically making notes and time markers of our entire conversation. So at the end, I'm looking at it and I go through with red highlighter on my screen, the best, the juiciest bits. I go, loved it when he said that. Yeah, that was a bit boring. We don't need that. I kind of said that twice. I said that in three places. We'll just use one. That's what you do. And again, the reason I edit down so much, I think, compared to a lot of podcasts is just because I come from this different background, which is being a radio producer, where you have a very strict time limit on what you can produce. You know, in the show I worked for and learned so much from is basically half an hour, but, you know, with sponsor announcements, you're talking about, I should know this, but you're talking closer to 25 minutes of actual story airtime. So the story you're producing for that show, I just filed one yesterday, 3 minutes plus a sort of 25 second intro. So I'm used to having to tell a story in such a short time that for me, having a heady 15 minutes, I mean, it feels luxurious to me.
Yeah.
So I use the same rules that I use as a radio producer, which is I get back from the interview, I log the tape, I go through going, that was really juicy. I know I want to use that. That I could kind of say that better than her there. And you end up with the best cuts, you know, what I consider like the juiciest cuts, the ones that are going to make people smile or make them laugh or make them furious. And you work from there. That's how I build my show. I transcribe the cuts I want to use, and then I build my narration around that. And I just feel that there's so much unedited stuff out there, and I'm so used to editing. And as I said, the luxury to me of having 15 or 20 minutes to talk about something feels like plenty compared to 3 minutes. And so And I from the very get-go, I got good feedback from people on the length. The first show I ever produced was 10 minutes. Admittedly, I'd intended to produce a show that was longer to half an hour, but people said, oh, I love the length. I love that it's so short. And as someone who downloads, gosh, maybe 15 or more podcasts, you know, a week, do I listen to them all in a timely manner? No. The first ones I go for are the ones that are shorter because I know I'll listen to them. Unfortunately, I mean, I hate to admit this, but I don't listen to This American Life that much anymore because it's a whole hour. I don't have time. I don't have time in my life to listen to that much audio. So the ones that I gravitate to are shorter. And then if I have time, I'll listen to the longer shows. So
yeah, and I think I mean, there's a whole, generally anytime this gets brought up within the podcasting circles that I discuss this in, you know, there's the, well, we just want to have a conversation and people are tuning in anyway, so who cares? Just they'll listen. If they don't like it, then they can tune out, and you know, that argument or discussion happens. But I feel like even with the few episodes that I was able to listen to of your show, that it kind of left me wanting to hear more, which at first
that's
it was
good.
Well, yeah. Well, sorry. In
Unless
general,
annoyed that I'd stopped early.
It's better than if I decide I don't want to ever hear this again and cancel their interview or something. But even about the topics, it's kind of like it left me wanting to hear more about the topic too, and so it, which I feel like most of the podcasts that I end up listening, it sort of made me reflect on most of the podcasts I listen to. I get to the end, I'm kind of like, oh, phew, I'm done. And there's good conversation in there, but I'm not like, I don't need more of it at this point. And I think we can all learn from that, myself especially. But I know I'm lazy when it comes to that that editing muscle, I guess, doesn't get worked
enough.
It's
just so much work. But it is a tremendous amount of work. I mean, I don't blame you if you're not used to doing it. And, you know, the reason I do it is just because that is what I've grown up in the radio world doing, just ruthless editing. And I also teach in the summer at Columbia Journalism School. I teach this sort of radio boot camp, and I tell the students that you've got to kill your babies. You've got to only keep the very juiciest stuff, and you have to get rid of everything else because people have really short attention spans. I know you argue that with a podcast, oh, but you know, the person may be driving and they've got you in your ears and they've got the time to get into it. But I don't know, just coming from the media world where getting people's attention is so hard and then keeping keeping their attention on what they're reading or listening to, it's such a part of my makeup that I can't stay away from the editing. And to me, letting someone ramble on for 1.5 minutes is just so exciting. So, you know, because my editor will be going, oh, 15 seconds too long, make it 13, cut to 11. I know that's going to happen later today when I do an edit for my other story. I know that he's going to be like, yeah, it was kind of boring. Can you cut that 11 seconds to like 8? It's 11 seconds.
Wow.
But that is what happens when you're filing a story that is only meant to be 2 minutes long.
Yeah. And that's, I think it would be such an interesting experience as a, even as professional a podcaster as there are out there, I don't know, like in my world, say a Dan Benjamin, a Leo Laporte, those are some of the people that I have looked to in my career or whatever, not career, in my hobby, I don't know. What, anyways, but and to have them submit a show that they do regularly, which, I mean, again, you know, they're quote unquote, you can't see my air quotes, popular and generating income and whatever, so good for them. But just in terms of that spirit of journalism and storytelling, to submit a story, quote unquote, whatever that looks like, in to an editor and see what happened, an audio editor, I guess, or what, is that the right vernacular? I don't know if that's the right term.
For just an editor, but they're working at a radio show.
Yeah, it would be such an interesting, to me anyways, an interesting experience, I guess, to hear and to get feedback on something like this, you know, you and I having this discussion. Because I have, like you said before, with even with men, women things, with audio podcasting, it's kind of what I've heard all the time has been just more like 45 minutes to an hour discussion. It rambles a bit here and there, like I'm doing right now. And then, but it's, you know, overall good or whatever. And so that's kind of what I replicate in my own experience. And, always searching for ways to improve and get better. And so, and like I said, flex that creative muscle when it comes to audio. I'm curious about, I guess, you'd mentioned the Columbia Journalism School where you teach a boot camp. Is that something so podcasters or people in audio out there who are listening, is that something they could look into, or what's the...
Well, if they want to part with about $60,000 US, okay, then they're more than welcome to look into it. I mean, this is graduate school. This is Columbia Journalism School, which is, you know, a grad school. And it ain't cheap, I can tell you that. And I don't know what it's going to cost this year, but I know that it's really expensive. So it's really, you know, I think it's considered one of the top three, and perhaps it is now considered the top journalism school in the US, that and Berkeley on the West Coast. So people who want to go there are pretty serious about becoming journalists. And actually the audio boot camp, they're forced to do it whether or not they've even considered radio or audio. So sometimes, you know, you get people who are either used to writing for print or just have no interest in audio and think it's uncool, like I did. And it's really fun talking to them and teaching them how much you can learn and how just experimenting with audio takes you to a completely different place, and you can do things you could never do with print writing. And often they get completely converted, and it's great to see that at the end, because it's so creative. That's why I like it so much, because you can be so creative with your storytelling. But yeah, it is not, it's quite the investment. So do consider that before applying.
Right. And so I guess failing that, then something like the site you'd mentioned maybe would be, is there other sites you'd recommend as far as just, you know, in reading and sort of learning a bit more about the craft of storytelling in journalism and podcasting? Anything that you have, if you don't have something off the top of your head, you can email me or whatever later too, that something that comes up and I can put it in the show notes, but I hate to put
you on the spot. So it's interesting. Well, it's the same site that I mentioned, transom.org. It's funny you should ask this, because I've just started working with this a journalist, but she's never touched audio, who wants to start a podcast from scratch. And she was asking for things to read, and I gave her the same thing, because I looked online, and honestly, I mean, you may even have interviewed some of these people, you know, the podcast man or the podcast answer man. I'm completely forgetting his first name, which is terrible.
Cliff
Ravenscroft.
Yeah.
Ravenscroft. So, you know, he has a course out there, maybe, you know, which you probably know is kind of $2,000. And it's a different kind of podcasting than what I do. It is much more people sitting at home and the ability to interview somebody remotely. But she wants to learn more of a storytelling, edited type of podcast. So I said, really, the only resource that I'm aware of that is the Transom. And it's a great site, because not only do they have these extremely useful gear reviews, but they also have, you know, pieces and interviews with people about what do you do if you're filing from home? You know, what's the best circumstance if you don't have a studio? Do you do it in your clothes closet, which is what I do? Do you buy a special little booth to put around your head? You know, stuff like that. And they also talk about storytelling. So I think it's a great resource for people who want to know more about this type of audio and podcasting and storytelling. I mean, you can probably find stuff just by Googling. I mean, I know Ira Glass, who hosts This American Life, he has definitely talked about this kind of thing before. And you can probably find some of his talks just by Googling. Like, he did a talk on Reddit. I wonder if that's available, that was very popular, that was really interesting. But he's probably also been interviewed, and I would think some of that stuff would be really easy to find just by like doing Ira Glass interview in Google.
Yeah, certainly. That's definitely, I was just trying to find, there was a comic book he put out, How to Make Radio. Yeah, I just found it. Okay. I'll put a link here, which it's at thisamericanlife.org/about/make-radio. But I'll put a link in the show notes too, so that people can find it later. It's kind of an illustrated comic book of how he puts together a story, I guess, or they put together a story for This American Life. So interesting little different kind of resource. And yeah, that's the podcast Answer Man, Cliff. There's, to me, and again, maybe it's just my worldview of what I see on the web, plenty of that kind of stuff, but not as much, yeah, like the storytelling, the almost
crafting.
Definitely like that idea of, okay, let's try and elevate this a bit, not in a pretentious way, but just like,
yeah,
we can try and do different things with this medium. And I think that'll come because like I said, I feel like it's getting fairly watered down with an hour of debate over Apple's latest iPhone or whatever, which is fine, but yeah, and I'm guilty of that as well. So, as I'm going to be recording a show this afternoon, that we do some of that kind of stuff, and it's all fun. But in closing up here, as I come to the end of my hour, my luxurious 60 minutes of discussion,
yes,
hopefully people have stuck around. One thing I do ask all the guests is the podcast that you listen to, and then also what app, device, you know, medium are you? Where are you listening to them these days? And so I don't know if you have your podcast player.
Well, now you're making me go there, because I don't want to leave anything out, because I mean, it's a little bit fluid, you know, because sometimes I try things and then I decide, maybe it's not so worth it. But one other podcast, an indie podcast that I think is really interesting, is called Authentic South. And if you're interested in, you know, obviously Southern American culture, it's great music. And again, it's pretty short. It's sort of like mine. He comes from a sort of multimedia background. He's a journalist, this guy called Tanner Latham. And he has what I think is a great show about sort of Southern culture. It's a sort of combination of interviews and sometimes music. And it's always, you know, under 15 minutes, I would say. So that's definitely one that, that I recommend. And then I listen to, you know, I love Spark from CBC. That's one of my new favorite podcasts. I also listen to another CBC show, Under the Influence. Do you listen to that?
Yeah.
Terry Riley's podcast about marketing. I think that's really interesting. I mean, you know, I'm not I'm not always interested in all the topics, but I think again, talk about well-produced. I mean, he has a whole team of people helping him. So that's one of the ones I really like when that's on. I listen to, I have This American Life. I have to say, I don't always get to it now because, as I mentioned, the length is really, something that sort of defeats me a little bit. But let me just look now. I listen to Planet Money, the NPR podcast, a fair amount. There's one, I've just started listening to another Mule podcast called This Is Actually Happening. It's an interview with somebody, you know, with something really sort of life-changing has happened. So, an interview with somebody who's, you know, after many years of marriage, what happened when her dad said he was gay, or what happened when you leave the guy you've been with for years, you know, something like that. It's like a pivotal point in somebody's life. I listened to a bunch of like BBC podcasts. Like I like Woman's Hour, and not surprisingly, that was kind of my inspiration for my show. And there's a show called Word of Mouth from the BBC, which is about language. And I'm really interested in kind of language and the way we use language. So that is something. Freakonomics. I do like a bit of Freakonomics. There's a show called, I should say this because I work in the same shared space as this guy called Blank on Blank. Have you ever come across that?
No,
that's another. It's a shorty, and again, it is produced. It's a good idea. He gets journalists to let him know if they have like old interview tape of some really interesting interviewee. So say you interviewed somebody famous 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Do you still have some of that tape left over? And then they send in the tape and he crafts a little podcast out of it with him coming in with narration. So they've had people like Jack Black, Farrah Fawcett, Barry White, Grace Kelly. I mean, they've had all sorts of, it's like leftover tape that sort of never necessarily made it into the print interview that gets crafted into this little podcast. And so it's just sort of quirky and fun and it's short. And now it's turned into a really interesting animated series. So now it gets tens of thousands of views on YouTube because PBS caught sight of it and decided they would like to pay to animate these little podcasts. So now it's a sort of animated series as well, which is really cool for David Gerlach, who hosts it. Sometimes I listen to the Dan Savage's sex podcast, Savage Lovecast. I must admit, I'm a bit behind on that. There's another female-hosted podcast called Destination DIY, which is basically about creating things, and that comes from a woman called Julie Sabatier out of, I'm gonna say Portland. I hope it's Portland and not Seattle. I'm pretty sure it's Portland. So there are various more, but those are the ones, some of the I would say 15 or 16 that I tune into every week.
Yeah, well, that's a good list and a good variety too of.
Themes.
Yeah, possibly new stuff too for folks who maybe aren't. I think just about everybody I've interviewed has mentioned This American Life in some capacity, and so it's kind of funny. Maybe I'll go back at some point and sort of build a tally of popular podcasts that podcasters mentioned. But no, there's some good variety in there too. Where do you typically listen? You mentioned you don't drive a lot or at all. So
no.
What are you listening to and what app do you listen to it on if you're?
So I usually listen, like sometimes when I'm walking, you know, I do a lot of walking in New York. So walking to and from the subway, sometimes I'm still listening on the subway, although I find the subway gets really loud. So I'll have to either pause it or turn it way up and still the roar of a train will obliterate the words coming out of somebody's mouth. So subway, not the best place, but I do end up listening to them on the subway. So for me, it's doing errands, it's going to the gym, it's at the gym, it's even just doing stuff in my apartment, like boring things like laundry or dishes. I'll listen to a podcast when I'm doing that. And sometimes if I'm traveling on a bus or a train to get somewhere, which I probably do more than most people, because of where I live and not having a car, again, that's when I listen. I until recently, I had my little iPod Nano that I got several years ago. And the reason I have this, I really like this device, is because, of course, I'm a radio freak and it has an FM radio on it. So I still use my Nano a lot to listen to podcasts as well as the radio. But actually, I just got an iPhone last year. And of course, I have the podcast app. So now I'm actually listening to some of them on my phone and some of them on my iPod Nano.
Nice. I think that's, speaking of previous guests, I think you're the first Nano listener on record that I can recall anyways, for whatever that's worth. But
well, it's tiny, it's small, and I was asked by my then boyfriend, what kind do you want? And he said, this one has a radio on it. And he knew I was nuts about radio. So I said, I want the one with the radio. And so that's why I have a Nano.
There you go.
And maybe now they all come with radios. I've no idea. But and I find my iPhone runs out of juice so quickly that I'm much likelier to still have some juice on my iPod than my phone. So I do often end up listening to them on the iPod.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I've noticed. I know my wife too. She has an iPad mini that she listens to, you know, when she's doing other stuff. It seems obvious. I guess maybe playing audio, you're using the speaker and as well as processing stuff. And so that's why it drains. But yeah. It's not a bad idea if you're doing a lot of podcast listening to just have a dedicated device like a Nano or a Shuffle even, I guess. I think they can play podcasts.
Exactly.
And then you're not, you know, if that dies, you're not worried about still being able to communicate with the world outside.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But interesting. All right. Well, I think that's an hour, and I won't be editing it down to 3 minutes or 5:15 or this time. As much as I would love to try someday, I'll try that. But where can folks find you and follow you on the internet, Ashley?
Oh, so, well, the website for the show is just thebroadexperience.com. And then there's also, I have a website, ashleymilne-tight.com, without the hyphen. Might have to check your site to work out how to spell that. and then on Twitter, again, my name is just Ashley Milne-Tight, without the hyphen. Bit of a mouthful, but I wasn't clever enough to think of a kind of funky Twitter handle. So, and then, you know, the show has a Facebook page as well. The Broad Experience has a Facebook page. So... I bet it's all. How do you know if all your listeners guys? I'm really curious. I bet they are, aren't they?
I don't know. I've never done a survey. I would imagine, you know, given what, like,
probably
what we
talked.
Yeah, in podcasting, I am not all guys. I don't think, but
right.
So, and actually, in light of what we were talking about earlier, I am. If there is female women podcasters out there who are listening to this show. Because maybe you listen to The Broad Experience or any other podcast for that matter, but you're doing podcasting. I am looking for more women to talk about podcasting with. So if you hit up sskTN.com/contact, fill out the form and let me know, or on Twitter, I'm iChris on Twitter. I'd love to connect with you and get a conversation going about setting up a time. Actually, next week I have Nicole Spag, I think is how you say her last name. I joked with Anna when she was on that I think I'm going to stop having people on who have difficult last names to spell to pronounce. And then here I go and do it to myself. But anyways, she's in a video game parenting podcast realm, I guess. And either that, this is what's fun about podcasting and the web in general, obviously, is either that name will be really familiar to you or you have no idea who she is, and you'll find out more about her next week on the show. But so yeah, there is. I was looking through the roster of folks that I've chatted with, and it's probably off the top of my head, you know, 4 or 5 of the 37 shows have been with women, and so definitely want to bring that number up in terms of parity. And so,
well, I can probably help. I can actually think of a female podcaster in Australia who'd be good for you to talk to.
Perfect. I have a brother-in-law in Australia that I want to go visit, so I'll. No. I wish I had the budget for that. But no, yeah, that would be good though. I'll get
you. As long as you can, yeah. She does all her interviews on Skype. So yeah. It's just a question of getting the timing right.
Yeah, no, I do a show with my brother-in-law. He's over in Byron Bay area anyways. And so we have to always coordinate times and stuff, but can certainly work that out. All right. Well, thank you, Ashley, for coming on the show. And
thank you for having me.
Thank you to you folks who are listening out there. As I mentioned, I'm iChris on Twitter. You can follow SSKTN on Twitter at SSKTN, and of course the website SSKTN.com. If you may be aware, but some friends and I are building a new site for podcasts that this show and a few others will be moving to in the near future, goodstuff.fm. And so you can follow that on Twitter, visit the website, sign up for the newsletter, that kind of stuff, to be made aware when the site finally launches in March here, hopefully. Knock on wood, cross your fingers, all that kind of stuff. So thanks for listening. Have a great day.